and so know quite a bit about it. But really, it is it's probably the most common condition that we see in the neurologic practice. Other than maybe migraine and low back pain, essential tremors is probably one of the most common things we see neurologically. We estimate it affects about 5% of people over the age of 60, and by the time you reach 80 years old, it may be as high as maybe 20%, so 10 to 20% range. So it gets to be pretty significant. And basically, almost everybody with essential tremor has at least some degree of disability, something they've changed in their life or had to modify because of their tremors. So that's kind of the first point. The other thing that we are starting to realize or starting to look at is whether essential tremor is associated with greater risk of other types of neurologic impairment. So that's something we've been looking at specifically at our lab through our Brain Bank program here in Phoenix, Arizona. So some of the studies, for instance, there's a longitudinal study that was done in Spain suggesting that people with tremor are more likely to get dementia as they get older. There was a similar study done suggesting people with essential tremor are more likely to get Parkinson's disease, so that the tremor was going to convert into Parkinson's disease. And there was even one study that suggested that people might have a greater risk of actually dying if they had essential tremors. So these are just some studies that have been done maybe over the last five years or so. And so this really prompted us to start to look at this a little bit more systematically through our aging study here in Phoenix. So we had this very large aging study with as many as 1,000 people enrolled at any given time. Some of them have Parkinson's disease, some of them have Alzheimer's disease. At any rate, it's allowed us to look at what we see in people who have tremor and follow them over time. So I thought I'd give you a little bit of statistics that we have kind of learned from these folks. So first of all, about 9% of our population of just sort of elderly controls, older people, have essential tremor. And the average age in our group is about 80 years old or so. And we have a large population of people who have actually gone on to pass away and donate their bodies to science. And so that's allowed us to actually study some of the pathology findings. So one of the first things that we've learned through our studies is that we don't find an increased risk of dementia. In fact, if anything, we find that essential tremor has a lower risk of cognitive decline over time. As you follow people out 5 and 10 years, there actually seems to be a lower risk. So we puzzle a little bit about what that might mean and why are some studies finding a higher risk and some studies finding a lower risk. And I think we really need to look more at that. In fact, that's kind of our next stages of study. So we've also done a cross-sectional study just of people with essential tremor and compared them to controls and found no greater risk of any sort of cognitive impairment overall. So that's one of the first things we've learned. The other thing we've learned on looking at on the pathology of people with essential tremor. So these are people who have donated their brains and their bodies to science after they pass away. So this allows us to look at kind of the relationship between some of these neurodegenerative conditions. Some of you may know that, the absolute way to diagnose Alzheimer's disease, for instance, is on pathology. So same with Parkinson's disease. That's the most secure way of diagnosing these conditions. So we have found no relationship between Parkinson's disease and Alzheimer's disease in people with ET. So there's these things called Lewy bodies in the brain, which indicate that people are at risk for developing Parkinson's disease. So they may be people who have no clinical features other than tremor, but then they have these Lewy bodies in the brain, which suggests that they might be at higher risk for developing Parkinson's had they lived longer. And we're actually finding that's no difference between the people with ET and the people who have no tremor, so no increased risk of those Lewy bodies in the brain. So no increased risk of Alzheimer's disease pathologically, and then another condition called PSP. So there's some studies that say maybe higher risk, but then what we're finding as we really start to look at this systematically is that there does not seem to be a higher risk. So The next thing I thought I would talk about, so that's Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, some of these other neurodegenerative conditions, and in short, we're not finding a relationship there. So the next thing to talk about is whether essential tremor may be its own neurodegenerative disease. So is there evidence for that? So you're all kind of familiar that, you know, ET starts very mildly and then over years starts to you know, expand, starts to increase in the amplitude of the tremor and the degree of disability. And so that might suggest that maybe this is a neurodegenerative disease. So, and so the first place to look for that, or at least the first place we've all kind of thought to look for that, is in the cerebellum of the brain. So the cerebellum controls movement. So if you go to, say, reach for your coffee cup and bring your coffee cup to your mouth, it is your cerebellum that allows you to do that very smoothly. So, and if you have tremor, obviously that tremor is going back and forth and contributing to your inability to do that. So the cerebellum was a kind of a logical place. Well, maybe there is a problem with the cerebellum, and that's why people develop tremors. So we started to look at this. There's a couple of groups, a group in Colombia and our group, both of whom have been funded by the IETF over the years. Both of our groups have started to look at this. And there's a group of neurons in the cerebellum called Purkinje cells. So those are the neurons that kind of are representative in the cerebellum. So the thought is if it's neurodegeneration, you have neuronal loss, right? And so these Purkinje cells potentially may be lost. So it's interesting. The group in Colombia has actually found that Purkinje cells actually seem to be lost more likely in people who have ET. So, whereas our group actually finds almost the exact opposite. We find that essential tremor brains look very, very similar, very, you know, basically squeaky clean normal. We are not finding any abnormalities in them. And the interesting thing is I think we're both probably right, and we're just kind of starting on this pathway to figure out why that is. So, and a lot of this has come from additional funding from the IETF. So first there's a thought that you may see the changes in more advanced essential tremor. So suggesting it's not a primary thing, you know, it's not the reason you have essential tremor, but maybe more of a consequence of having tremor for a very long time. So the group in Colombia actually studies kind of more advanced disease, where we tend to study kind of more early disease. And so that may actually explain why there's differences between those groups. And so you say, okay, well, why might that be? So if it's not a primary problem, it's a secondary problem, why might that be happening? And we really don't know just yet, but it is something that we're working on. So there's some thought that potentially just tremor itself is too stimulating, essentially, to the brain, that the brain actually starts to react to having tremor overall. So Dr. Kuo in Colombia has been looking at this concept of excitotoxicity, where you look at the brain's sort of reaction to either tremor or other types of stimulants over time, and actually showing that there is some evidence for this excitotoxicity in the brain. So that's kind of interesting. I think we still have to kind of sort out why that is. Is it tremor itself? Is it potentially medications that have been used to treat tremor over time? Or are there other factors that contribute to that? So that's kind of one interesting thing. So another thing that we are looking at kind of pathologically is these GABA changes in the brain. So we know that a lot of the drugs that we use to treat essential tremor act on GABA receptors. So things like gabapentin and even primidone and those types of drugs, a lot of the seizure medications we use work on GABA. And we know GABA is a big inhibitory chemical in the brain. And we also are starting to learn now that GABA is abnormal in essential tremors. And it may be that there are different parts of the brain that are abnormal with respect to GABA. So that's a big area of research that we're still not quite sorted out overall. So that aspect of excitotoxicity and then GABA chemistry, I think are starting to get at kind of the root of what we think might be happening in essential tremor. long and short, and then the idea of sort of neurodegeneration, if it's happening at all, maybe a more sort of advanced or sort of later stage finding. So, again, these things are still very much in the area of research, so if you ask me again in another year or so, we may be maybe changing our minds about that. So that's it. That's the kind of talk on neurodegeneration, the aspects there, the kind of chemistry involved in essential tremor. So, and then the final thing I just wanted to kind of briefly touch on was just genetics in essential tremors. So, and this is where we're actually kind of still stumped. I mean, most of us realize that essential tremor tends to run in families. You've all heard the term hereditary essential tremor. And yet, but even though we know that there's a genetic component to it or hereditary component to it, we have really had a hard time finding genetic contributions to ET. So one of the first ways that's been looked at, and this is all kind of studies done long ago, but looking at just families where there's a very high concentration of essential tremor from generation to generation, and you look for genes in those families that track with the people with the tremor, versus the same with other family members that don't have tremors. So you do these kind of family studies. So, and those have been remarkably, you know, unproductive to even with very large families at producing genes. So the next strategy, which has been done kind of more recently, are what are called GWAS studies. So these are called genome-wide association studies. So, and these where you take large populations of people with essential tremor, and just pool all their samples together, and then you take a large sample of people without essential tremor, and you pool all their samples, and you basically look for genes that are just slightly positive. So they might not be like mutated genes, but they're more like variants of genes that actually contribute to essential tremors. So these are these where the genes are associated with the condition, so these genome-wide association studies. So they're variants of the gene. They're not mutations, but variants that may contribute to risk. And so far, again, we've had a lot of trouble with that. There was some despite these very large, well-done studies, studies in North America, studies in Europe, really have not found genes that really say, you know, yes, this is a variant that's associated with ET. There was one called Lingo, and some of us have received funding over the years to study Lingo in a little bit more detail. And there's some debate about whether Lingo is relevant either genetically, you know, looking at these gene studies, or is it related pathologically, you know, do we actually find changes in this Lingo protein in the brains of people with ET? And I think there's still kind of a debate on it. So that was kind of the last sort of hot topic in ET. So I think we still need to do some work on the genetic aspect. So my guess, and I'm just going to kind of put this out there as a guess, is that essential tremor isn't one gene, first of all, that there's probably several genes that contribute to the risk factor, and that essential tremor may be different in different family members, so that even though the symptoms look the same in different family members, the genes that contribute to that are different. So maybe there are four or five genes that contribute in one family, and maybe in another family it's two or three different genes that contribute. And this is why I think we're having trouble is that there's so many kind of different types of essential tremor that we can't just pool everybody together and start to look at them. So I'm going to finish there. I kind of talked about, you know, pathology. I talked about the links between that and neurodegeneration. Talked a little bit about the genetics. So I thought I would then now turn it over to Dr. Hallett to talk a little bit about, you know, where do we go from there? How do we learn from what we kind of know about know about the biology of essential tremor? How do we translate that into treatment? I thank you for your attention, and then I'm going to hang on till the end, and we'll be doing questions at the end.
Right. So this is Mark Hallett here. Can you hear me all right? I'm not sure that I'm properly connected.
Yeah, we can hear you fine, Dr. Hallett.
Ah, very good. Excellent. Excellent. So I'm at the National Institutes of Health, and my task was to deal with clinical trials that are ongoing, And for this, I certainly am aware of all of the research activities that the IETF has supported. And in preparing for the telephone call, I also looked on the website called clinicaltrials.gov. And for those of you that don't know about that particular website, it is an excellent source of information about clinical trials. Almost everything that is done in clinical trials is actually registered there. So if you're interested in finding out what's going on in terms of clinical trials, it is a good place to look. This is something sponsored by the U.S. government, and it's a very good source of information. In any event, let me give you a sense of all of the work that's going on in clinical trials at the current time. The first topic that I'll talk about are oral drugs, things that you can take by mouth. And one of the aspects, of course, that has been very interesting over many years, it's been known, is that ethanol is very effective in terms of treating people that have essential tremor. It makes the tremor go way down in amplitude. And almost none of the other oral drugs do as well as ethanol. We don't understand why that should be the case. And, of course, ethanol is not a great drug for chronic use because it has its own problems. But it is it would be nice to know exactly how ethanol works, because if one knew that, then it would be possible to use that information to develop other drugs that could work in the same way on the tremor but not have the ill effects of ethanol. So one of the projects that's been ongoing at the NIH, led by Dr. Dietrich Halpenberger, is to look a little more closely at what patients have their tremor affected by ethanol and which don't. There are many people that say that they are alcohol responsive, and some people say that they're not. And so the question is, from a quantitative point of view, what information can we learn about that? And Dr. Halpenberger has been giving a standard amount of ethanol to a very large number of patients and looking at this. One of the things that is very interesting is that there's very little correlation between what people say and what is actually the case. And that's probably because people are not that clearly aware, in fact, of exactly how much ethanol affects them. However, it is the case that there is a variable response to ethanol in different people. Some people do respond very well. Almost everybody responds at least a little bit. And one of the other things which is interesting in this regard is that one can see that the amount of benefit of ethanol depends in part on the blood level of ethanol. And people who do not respond well appear to have a lower blood level despite a standard dose of ethanol. So there is an interesting interaction between the absorption of ethanol and the efficacy of ethanol. So everyone responds at least a little bit, but there is a variation. Further work is ongoing in this regard, but I think that this will hopefully give some further hints as to what is the best type of approach to a oral therapy. Now, following up that particular line of thinking, there are other alcohols that are chemically related to ethanol. Ethanol has two carbon atoms in it, and there are other alcohols that have a different number of carbons. And one of the thoughts that came to us at the NIH is whether if you use a different alcohol, one with a different number of carbons, that you might be able to help the tremor but not get the ill effects of the ethanol. So over a period of years, we have been exploring that particular concept. And to make a very long story short, it is the case that an 8-chain alcohol, octanol, can be efficacious against essential tremor and doesn't appear to have the intoxicating manifestations. Following that point up a little bit more, we found that octanol is rapidly metabolized to another chemical called octanoic acid when it gets into the body. And then we did further studies on octanoic acid, and it turns out that octanoic acid also works. This is about the limit to what has been done so far. In order to go further, the octanoic acid and or the octanol would have to be better formulated in order to be ingested. Taking it raw is very unpalatable, but one has to take a relatively large amount of it in order for it to work. So this is an area for further investigation in terms of improving the formulation of the compound. In terms of other oral drugs, a number of patients have noted that taking marijuana has been helpful. And for this reason, medical scientists interested in this area have been trying to understand why. The active ingredient in marijuana are various types of cannabinoids, and one particular agent, cannabidiol, is an agent that might well be active. Now, in a grant that the IETF gave last year to Adrian Hanforth, he began to explore cannabidiol in a mouse model of essential tremor. The mouse model is where you give a drug called Harmaline to the mouse, and the mouse then develops a tremor. And it has been the case that all drugs that help human essential tremor also decrease Harmaline tremor in the mouse. So Hanforth has been exploring cannabidiol in the Harmaline model, and what he has found is that it does work, and now he has been trying to do studies trying to find out why it works. This has been work, as I say, that has been sponsored by the IETF in trying to understand this relatively important phenomenon. Now, following up this particular line of thought, Dr. Feda Nahab, who's at UCSD, put in a clinical grant to IETF in this year's cycle. And this was just funded relatively recently, and he's going to do a clinical trial in humans for cannabidiol. So it does appear, as I say, in animal models to work. There is anecdotal evidence that it works, and now with the help of IETF, it will be possible to do some first in human formal clinical trial to get objective evidence for its use. Not clear exactly when that trial will be starting, but I would expect it would be relatively soon. So those of you who are in the San Diego area might be thinking about participating in that trial that he'll be doing shortly. So another area of research in terms of oral agents has been with sodium oxybate. This is a drug that has been suggested by Stephen Frucht, who's in New York City. And he has been conducting studies of this for a number of years. Oxybate seems to work in situations where ethanol is also effective, and he has studied this in patients who have essential tremor. He has been continuing work in this area, trying to find out why it works. But I must say that this particular agent hasn't caught on as a very commonly used drug because it has a large number of side effects. And because of these side effects, I suspect that most doctors are not suggesting it, and most patients aren't, in fact, taking it. However, understanding how oxybate works, just like understanding how ethanol works, will be useful in the long run in terms of developing better agents. Now, again, carrying on to other drugs, you've already heard from Dr. Schill that there have been studies of anticonvulsants. These are drugs that help people that have epilepsy, and there are a large number of anti-epileptic drugs that have been studied. At the present time, one of the studies that is in fact ongoing now is a study of perampanel. Perampanel is a newly approved anticonvulsant, and this drug blocks excitatory neurotransmission in the brain. You heard from Dr. Schill about GABA, which is a neurotransmitter that produces inhibition, and perampanel is a drug that blocks excitation from what's called NMDA receptors. So there is some evidence for this potentially being useful, and Dr. Hanforth, who was also doing the cannabidiol study in mice, is doing the perampanel study in humans at the present time. That study is being financed, I believe, by the VA hospital where he works, which is also in Southern California. So those are the oral agents that are being investigated at the present time. I just note quickly that botulinum toxin can be injected into muscles that are tremoring, and that helps some people. This had been studied in the past. There aren't any new studies ongoing on that at the present time, as far as I know. Now, the next topic in terms of therapy is different types of invasive surgery. Probably many of you know that if you make a lesion in the thalamus, particularly in the ventral intermediate nucleus of the thalamus, that will block tremor. And this had been a method of treatment of tremor that had been present for a long time. There is now in the last several decades the use of deep brain stimulation using the same thalamic target and seems to have a similar use. The deep brain stimulation has been more popular than making a lesion because it doesn't actually damage the brain. It actually works by stimulating the brain rather than making a small area of damage. So deep brain stimulation has been pretty popular. It's been pretty effective. But it doesn't work as well as one would like in some individuals, and for this reason, there is a fair amount of research ongoing at the present time to try to optimize the methods for deep brain stimulation. There are a whole variety of studies that are ongoing. In one set of studies, there is exploration of which is the optimal target. Is it really the ventral intermediate nucleus of the thalamus, or is it some other nearby structure? So that's one. Another type of research that's ongoing is a simple high-speed stimulation, which is the way that DBS is done now, the best way of actually doing stimulation? Are there patterns of stimulation that would be better? Is it better to turn on and off the stimulation depending upon whether there's a actual tremor ongoing at the present time? All these things are being explored so that while DBS works and seems to work relatively well, there's a lot of ongoing research now in terms of optimizing it to make it even better. Now, another interesting aspect of what's going on in surgery at the moment is the development of focused ultrasound. As I mentioned earlier, lesions in the brain were known to be helpful before DBS was helpful, but the way that you make a lesion in the past had been to do to put a formal electrode into the brain and burn a hole or something like that at the relevant spot in the thalamus. Focused ultrasound is a non-invasive method for making such a lesion. Sending a strong pulses of ultrasound into the brain, it's possible to create this small lesion without actually putting an electrode into the brain itself. And therefore, lesion is coming back again, but using focused ultrasound rather than the more invasive approach. There have been a number of studies, small studies, that have been published already, and there's a large multi-center study that is just being completed now. The multi-center study is actually many different countries have been involved in this. And the rumors are that this is also a positive study. Now, one of the problems with lesions, and therefore is a similar problem with focused ultrasound, is that you can only do that on one side. Deep brain stimulation can be done on both sides, but lesions can only be done on one side, and that would be true of focused ultrasound as well. So focused ultrasound is an interesting experimental method now. It's a non-invasive way of making a lesion, and it may be very useful for people who have tremor mainly on one side or would be content with just treatment on one side. Further work is ongoing in this area. Now, the next topic has a similar aspect to deep brain stimulation, and the issue here is that if, in fact, rapid stimulation of the thalamus can be helpful, is it possible to get a rapid stimulation into the brain by stimulating non-invasively? And one potential way of doing that is to stimulate the cerebellum, because the cerebellum has a direct input into the relevant part of the thalamus. Now, there are ways of doing non-invasive stimulation now, and in particular, there's a technique called transcutaneous alternating current stimulation. And this can be done over the cerebellum. And in last year's IETF grant cycle, a grant was given to Dr. Welter in Paris to begin to explore high-frequency TACS of the cerebellum in order to see if this could, in fact, duplicate the effects of deep brain stimulation. And this work is just getting started now. Dr. Welter had a little bit of problems getting herself started with this work, but we've heard from her that things seem to be moving along better now, and that this type of work should be ongoing shortly. So this would be a non-invasive way of doing stimulation of the brain that might also help essential tremor. Now, the last area of research that I'd like to talk about in relation to treatment of tremor is mechanical damping of the tremor. Perhaps some of you have heard about the tremor spoon. This is one type of mechanical damping. It works similarly to noise suppression earphones, where a oscillation is identified and then fed back in opposite direction, so that it counterbalances the oscillation, and that's what dampens sound. And it can be used to dampen mechanical oscillations also. So if it's attached to a spoon, one can have a counterbalancing oscillation that will help maintain the spoon constant. Now, this type of information can be utilized in a more detailed way, looking at the entire oscillation of the limb. And if one does that, one can then begin to develop ideas about how to feedback oscillations into the entire limb. Stephen Charles, who is an investigator at Brigham Young University, has gotten an NIH grant to study in detail oscillations of the entire upper extremity of patients that have essential tremor. And using that information, he is planning to try to develop algorithms for counterbalancing that and thus dampen the tremor. We have been somewhat involved with this at the National Institutes of Health. He has asked us to help him make the original observations in these patients. We have been doing that with him. So he and his team are about halfway through making their observations, and then they'll go on to further develop these counterbalancing oscillations in the future. So that's the full range of what's going on in therapies at the present time. You can see there's a wide range of things. And hopefully some of them will become better and better in terms of ways of helping people that have essential tremor. So that's the end of what I wanted to comment on, and I think that leaves us about 15 minutes or so for questions of various kinds from the people who are listening.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hallett, Dr. Schill. So let's go ahead and open up our call for questions for the doctors. We'll be able to do about 15 minutes of questions. We're going to try to get to as many questions as we can. So if you have a question for the doctors, if you would please press star 5, that's star 5 on your phone now, you're going to hear a voice telling you on your phone that you've been unmuted and you can ask your question to the doctors. And then after you complete your question, we're going to go ahead and mute your phone again so we can get to as many questions as possible. So let's go ahead and get started with our question and answer and see if we have any. So again, just press star 5 on your phone if you have any questions for the doctors.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead and ask your question, sir.
Yes, I was wondering if there was any exercise I could use for my head and my hands. Is there any exercise that would help it ease it?
Yes, so this is Dr. Hallett answering. That is a very interesting question that patients often ask. Exercise generally is useful. There is a project at IETF funded about a year ago to answer that question, and I don't think that we've actually seen the final report of that yet. This is a formal study that's been done in Australia, and I recall that they were having a little bit of trouble getting themselves started with that project, but we should have a formal answer to that question relatively soon. In the meantime, I would think that, as I say, generally exercises are useful for people, but we don't know of any that are actually specific in helping the tremor. Holly, do you have any further comment about that?
No, other than, you know, this is just kind of based on what patients tell me. First of all, right after exercise, patients often have more tremor, and that's probably just the stimulant effect of the exercise and maybe the fatigue component after exercise. So But it's kind of logical that if you strength build, you know, you build the muscles, that can actually act as a dampening mechanism for that reflex circuit that gets enhanced in tremors. So at least theoretically, I think that it's logical to build, you know, at least do some strength toning for the muscles involved by tremor, although it'd be nice to see some studies to support that.
Okay. Do we have another question?
Hi.
Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
Yes. I believe I have the early stage of ET. And is there a likelihood that I might not go further, that I might be sort of cured?
Holly,
well,
do you want to answer?
Yeah, I'd be happy to answer that. So it's interesting when you're in a movement clinic like I am. I'm a movement disorder neurologist. I often see the patients that are very, you know, essentially more symptomatic. They're more advanced, so they're having more progression of their symptoms over time. So we tend to see the more highly affected patients, and those people are, I think, most of them getting worse over time. So, but what's interesting, when you come back into, like, our aging study where you're just following a large number of people who are just getting older, you will see a large number of people who just have very mild tremor that's been there for 10 or 20 years. I remember one fellow who's had tremor almost since childhood. So it looks very much like ET, but yet has been very, very slow in terms of any progression at all. So yes, I think there are people like that can have a very benign progression over time.
Great. Next question for us.
Let me just comment also that it's very hard to actually predict what's going to happen, however. This is something that needs a little more work. Some people do very well with very slow progression, as Dr. Schill said, and some people do get worse over time, and we don't know how to predict that yet.
Okay, next question. You may have a question for the doctor?
Yes, I do. This is my
name
is Richard. Is this my turn?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm wondering, I went to Stanford and I was diagnosed with ET, and I'm just wondering because the young lady who helped me and diagnosed me, she said, you know, stop drinking coffee, stop any caffeine, but I replaced it with alcohol, and I've gotten to the point where I drink more than I don't know. I'm sure there's other people that identify with me. I cannot believe that it works. Like none of the, you know, they prescribed me with all the different drugs, and over the 4 years. They never worked like alcohol does, but it does obviously have a side effect. And when you mention ethanol, is that alcohol?
Right.
Is that alcohol? I mean, that's like,
yeah,
you know,
right.
the pure form of alcohol. That's my question. Like, I've really switched one for another. The drinking of coffee, the caffeine, the addiction to that, and now I'm addicted to alcohol, and it's, you know what, it works so good that it scares me.
Right. Okay. So this is sort of the point that I was making earlier. When the average person says alcohol, they are really talking about ethanol. Ethanol is the chemical name of this compound with two carbon atoms and then a hydroxy group on it, and that makes it an alcohol. And I was trying to, for the purposes of what I was saying, I was trying to make it clear that of the different types of alcohols, because we've also been studying octanol, which is 8 carbons. Now, again, ethanol is the most effective agent that we know. And just like you say, it works extremely well, but it has a lot of very important side effects in terms of addiction and also drunkenness and other things that can potentially happen with it that aren't good. So we would hope that we would be able to develop oral agents that are as good as ethanol on the tremor, but don't have the same side effects. And that's the reason that we began the work with octanol, but of course there may be other agents that work in other ways. The fact that ethanol works so well gives us great hopes that there will be other agents that we'll be able to find, and this is an area of active research, of course. So I guess there's one other point to make, and that is caffeine. Caffeine can certainly worsen tremor. It doesn't happen in everybody, but it does happen in some people that it will worsen, so that many people will find that decreasing the amount of caffeine use will be helpful. So that's another aspect that was actually probably correct in your case as well.
Great. Next question. You have a question for us, Doc?
Yes. Am I on?
Yes, sir.
Yes.
Dr. Schill, I guess I have more of a comment than a question, but on genetics, you know, I'm 79, but both my grandparents had tremor, and they were like kissing cousins, I guess. My father and his sister both had tremor. Now, I have tremor. My brother doesn't have. And on the other side, some of my cousins have tremor. So, you know, it just seems to flow down, what is it, Mendel's Law or whatever, as far as inheritance goes, in our family anyway, that it's just strictly inherited all the way.
Right. I mean, you bring up a very good point, which is you have families, I mean, lots of families. I hear your story many times in the clinic where it's generation to generation, you know, maybe starting at a very young age and, you know, multiple family members and siblings, et cetera. So, and that's common. You think, well, why can't we find a gene for essential tremor when it very clearly runs in families? So, and I think what we're finding or what we're starting to conclude is it probably is multiple genes, even within a family, you know, maybe different one coming from the, you know, the grandparents' side or the grandmother's side and then the different one coming from the grandfather's side, that then, you know, then coalesce to form the conditions. So I think we've got to get smarter about how we do our genetic studies, and maybe part of that is to better understand the different types of essential tremor or so. And I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do that. It may be that we have to, you know, have, you know, the kind of progressive types, the non-progressive types, whether they have associated different types of neurologic symptoms with them. So I think that's what we've got to get a little bit better at, defining different types of essential tremor that we see in the clinic, and I think that'll help us pool people together in a smarter way so that we can actually start to find genes.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question for the doctor, so if we could get, we have time for one more, so somebody want to ask the last question?
Yes.
Great, go ahead.
Am I on? Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Is there any research on biofeedback?
I'm not aware of ongoing biofeedback at the present time. There are a number of different ways that one could think about biofeedback. One of them is to feedback the actual tremor itself, and other than these sort of dampening oscillations that I talked about earlier, that, as far as I know, hasn't worked very well. Another potential way of using biofeedback is just sort of for something like relaxation. And if people are calmer, often there is less tremor. So in that sense, it may be possible that some types of biofeedback may be helpful for some people. But in terms of an explicit biofeedback of the tremor itself, I'm not aware that there are any studies that show that it can work. Holly, do you have any other information on that?
Yeah, no, I'm not aware of any studies, although, again, like you say, logically, just in general, relaxation and awareness of tremor potentially can help to calm it down. So,
you know what? I think we got about five more minutes. I think we can probably get one more question in if we do it real quick. So we got one more. Let's do one more question for the doctors.
Hi. Is sudden bodily jerking a progression of essential tremor?
Is what? I'm sorry. Sudden jerking?
Sudden bodily jerking.
I see. So your whole body jerks? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. That particular symptom would not be a regular part of essential tremor. No, that sounds like something else is happening in this case. It's certainly, even though tremor is most common in the upper extremities, the arms, it can certainly spread to other body parts. The legs, the head, the voice can also be can also have tremor, but that wouldn't ordinarily include body jerking. And so it sounds like that's something different, and so you would have to talk to your doctor about what that would be.
Okay. Well, thank you all for joining us today. That's all the time that we've got. We want to thank you for participating in our teleconference call. Hope you enjoyed the information that was presented by Dr. Hallett and Dr. Schill. I want to say thank you for them to taking the time today for presenting on the teleconference. And just so you all know, there will be a recording of the teleconference posted on the IETF website next week. If you want to hear it again, or if you have some friends who were unable to join us on the call and wanted to hear it, feel free to direct them to the website, and it'll be there under education events. Thank you again for joining us. We hope you all will consider donating to the IETF so we can continue to offer these free educational programs along with funding research grants and increasing ET awareness. And thank you again for joining us, and good night. We hope you can join us for our next conference call, and we will have that date and topic selected here very soon and let you all know so you can save the dates on your calendar. Hope you all have a great 4th of July holiday with your families, and stay safe if you're traveling, and look forward to hearing and talking with you on our next teleconference call. Good night.
The host has joined the conference.
I don't hear that. I put in conference.